do it without him.
We're going to start in a few minutes. The mayor is apparently on his way. We'd like to wait for him before we start. And I just want to, while we're waiting for him, say that we've changed the format of this to some extent, where we'd like it to be more of a conversation among both the panelists and you folks in the audience. And so the mayor is going to make a presentation, probably not that long, about the NOAA for Life initiative. And then the other panelists are going to respond to what he presents and also related to the work they've done in their communities. After that, we'll really open things up for discussion. So the presentations will be less formal than the program implies, but I think that the conversation will be far more interesting as a result. So if you folks just be patient for a few minutes, the word is the mayor is like trying to find his way to the room at the moment. This room is not the easiest one to find. Can everyone hear me okay, by the way, because we may or may not be able to get a hand mic, and if we don't have a hand mic, we're going to just talk, because this mic doesn't detach. We're going to get started. I have a couple of slides that have no content on them, so we'll get through them fairly quickly. And then I'd like to make a few opening remarks, and then we'll pass things on to the mayor. Here are three panelists. I'll introduce them individually as they get ready to speak. And this is the most important slide, which says that we have no relationships to disclose and no conflicts of interest. So on that note, I'm going to come forward. And I just want to say a couple of things in opening. This is a session that is going to reflect, I think, the state of the art of where you find prevention disconnect. And I've been doing this work for some 30 years. When I first started, the primary approach to youth violence prevention was containment and reactive response, primarily punitive reactive response, and quite frankly, it wasn't terribly successful. And over the past 30 years, it shifted from response to much more of a proactive prevention approach to things, with a real understanding that youth violence is in fact preventable. The other shift that's equally important is that early on, much of the focus was dealing with kids who were already in trouble. So it was very individually focused, and it was like pulling kids out of the river one by one as they fell in. Much more recently, it's been a real shift towards community-level strategies, neighborhood-level strategies that are oriented to have much more of a population-level effect, so that we really change the environment around kids, which then greatly influences their risk, their behavior, and the resiliency they have to deal with the factors that influence their involvement or lack of involvement with violence. So my hope is that by the end of the session, we'll have a feel for where this field has really moved. And in the realm of public health, a 30-year span is quite short, actually. So the field has moved, in fact, quite rapidly and in very exciting ways. We're going to open the session. We're in New Orleans, so we're going to open the session by what's happening in this city, which is, I think, quite exciting. And an introduction to the mayor, I want to say that about 2 or 3 years ago, somebody sent me, a colleague sent me an email with a link on it, and with a note saying, you've got to see this. So
speech. I don't know what speech you're talking about.
I think it was a National Mayor's Conference or something.
Oh, good. Yeah, I'm going to talk to you real quick.
10 minutes.
Okay, can I stand up?
You can stand up. Okay.
Hi there, everybody. I feel like I want to go to sleep.
By the way, my city is just like your city.
See, like people in New Orleans think, well, we must be worse than everybody else because that's just how we were trained to think, right? We drink a lot, we smoke a lot, right? We have fun, we don't go to school, we don't read, we don't write, we just party, we just have Mardi Gras, we don't have real jobs, we just like having people come down. That kind of mentality, that's not really like we are, but that's what people think, and so we start thinking about ourselves. We're like, we must be different. But it turns out that we're a lot like everybody else. And it took us a long time to figure that out, and it's not necessarily consequential, but we have to fix ourselves. But if you're looking for a national solution, you can actually find the solution on the streets of New Orleans. So what is here? We have a murder rate in this city that is, if it's not higher than everywhere else in the nation, it's right up there. Now, this is interesting. I just used the word rape. Do you want to talk about rape, or do you want to talk about people? Well, politicians like to talk about rape. The reason they like to talk about rape is because if you have a big city like New York and you have 8 million people and only 600 people got shot, the correlation between the 600 people and the 8 million makes your rate low. So it makes you look good. I'm fighting crime, my rate is low. But 600 human beings were killed, right? Or if you're Chicago. Now, if you're New Orleans and 130 people get killed and you only have 360,000 people, then your rate is high. And somehow you're worse, but you only lost 130 American citizens. They lost 600. And then we get in arguments like that about that. So I'm thinking, well, that's just a weird argument. I count deaths in bodies, not in ratios. Unless you want to make up some story about how kids in New York are safer than kids in New Orleans. Well, the answer to that question will be, well, like, what kids are you talking about? So think about me. I'm on MSNBC, Meet the Press, Fox News, whatever. And the question is posed to me, hey, Mr. Mayor, is your city safe? What's the answer to that question? You want to know what the answer is? It depends on who you are. It depends on what you look like. It depends on what neighborhood you live in. And it depends on what you're doing there. Like, see everybody in here? Y'all are as safe as anybody else anywhere in the world. Don't worry about it. You're good to go. But if you're a young African-American man between 16 and 25, and you live in one of four neighborhoods, you might be in a little trouble. And if you're in the small percent of kids that have been acting out since the kids, you got a bullseye on your back, and you're actually likely to get killed. As a matter of fact, to the level, the way you would now, I'm starting to understand about y'all's language in public health, right? When you think about it in the ratios, you're actually like an endangered species. You're like really at high, high risk for morbidity. Isn't that like a word y'all use for like dead? Why y'all can't just say dead? Why you gotta say morbidity? High in incidence of cancer as opposed to high morbidity rate. The public doesn't understand any of that. Y'all spent all that money learning in school. Y'all can just talk plain English. Folks would understand it. So if you think about it, I started looking around saying, first of all, what is happening in the city? And what was happening and what is happening? Is basically this. The young African-American men between 16 and 25 have engaged in, and I'm going to use this word purposefully because I want to tweak you. I want to tweak your conscience. We have produced a culture of violence. Did you hear what I just said? So now we can fight about whether it's really a culture. I didn't say genetic. I said a culture. What is culture? Culture, by definition, is a behavioral pattern that has developed over time that has cemented itself into place, like the way your mama makes apple pie. Your mama makes it different than your mama makes it. They just do. You know why? Because the recipes got handed down from time to time, and somebody put cinnamon in it, and somebody put sugar, and so it tastes a little bit different. Or gumbo, or music, the kind of jazz they have, whatever, whatever, whatever. It's developed over time. And what's happened, right, as a matter of learned behavior, is that these young men, for a whole bunch of reasons, which we can argue about forever, have learned the behavior of how to deal with each other. And the way they resolve their differences is at the butt of a gun, and they kill each other over crazy, silly stuff. Things that you and I would consider to be crazy, silly. So, hence, when I saw that as the mayor, I said, this is irrational. It doesn't make any sense. It's unreasonable. It's unnatural. I said those words at press conferences that people film. Until I sat down and talked to the boys. Tell me what's going on. I don't understand. That was your friend. Why did you shoot him? He disrespected me. He disrespected you. He might have disrespected you a lot for you to shoot him in the head. Oh, no, he just said my girlfriend was a something. I said, that was it? Yeah, that's the way things are. Why did you have a gun? Well, I mean, you either kill or be killed. What? Well, how old are you? 18. Well, wait a minute. What about, no, I don't understand. So all of a sudden, we start to be like, what the hell is going on? So I told my team, look, my mission is to do one very simple thing. I would love to be able to change the world. But I have one very simple mission here. I want black boys. I didn't say brown boys. I didn't say black girls. I want black boys to stop shooting each other. That's what I want. You can want whatever you want. And whatever you want is fine. And I'm sure it's just as important as what I want. But what I want, now why do I want that? I want that because my data reflects to me that I have black boys shooting black boys. That's what I have. Now you can say to me, but I want to concentrate on Ferguson. That's okay. You want to concentrate on Ferguson? That's great. You want to focus on Trayvon Martin? That's okay. That's about injustice. That's about unequal treatment of the law. And it's about a whole bunch of really important things attached to it. That's not what I'm trying to do at the moment. I want to find the gateway problem that's the hardest that nobody wants to talk about because you got race and class and history and a lot of things wrapped around it. And you have people dying. How many people are dying? That's a good question, right? How many people are dying from violence on the streets of America? Because, you know, we went to war over 3,000 people who died on September 11th. One of our citizens got beheaded the other day. ISIS is a major threat, right? Over at Israel, right? In Israel, with the PLO, lots of things happened and people got killed. How many people have to get killed before we're moved to action? And who has to get killed? And what are the circumstances under which they have to get killed in order for us to move as a community? Well, we know that if a young African-American boy is shot by a police officer or another citizen under specious circumstances, that moves us, right? How do we know that? That's not an opinion. I mean, it's a fact. People got moved for Gina a couple years ago. People got moved for Trayvon. People got moved, right, in Ferguson. That moved us to action. So I'm going to ask you a question. When 628,000 American citizens are killed in America since 1980, that's a fact. That's a verifiable fact, as I would say. Now, ask yourself the question, well, how many people, besides it being alive, how many people actually is it? Like, so we can have some comparison, because like, evidently, if it's bigger and badder, maybe we would want to do that. Do you know how many people that is? It's more American citizens that were killed in all, that would be spelled A-L-L, all of the wars, that would be spelled W-A-R-S, all of the wars. Y'all can figure out how to spell off. All of the wars in the 20th century. So here's my question to America. Why doesn't that move us to do something? And if, in fact, that's not the way we want to be, how would we think about changing that? And do we think about it in a way that stops us from really understanding what it is? Now, the reason I want to focus on African-American men and boys shooting each other is because when you drill down on those statistics, what you find is, of course you know this, African-American community is 10% of the population in the nation, men are 5%. Right? But they make up 50% of the victims. Now, if you want to talk about injustice and unequal treatment, I'm trying to figure out why that number hasn't moved everybody in America to figure out what is going on. And the answer is because we don't value them and they don't have a constituency. That's what I think the answer is after a whole bunch of years of doing whatever I do. And I don't know why we don't value their lives or why they don't have a constituency, but that's a fact. And so what we have to figure out how to do is make sure people know their lives are valuable. And until we begin to value their lives, our lives will not be as valuable as they have to be. And we have to figure out how to get to the root of what that is. And the root way of getting there is not just through criminal justice, it's through public health. Because it is like a virus, and violence is a virus. That's what it is. and you can handle it through the criminal justice system, you have to, because let's be clear about this. Some of these young men are going to hurt you, and they're going to hurt each other, and they're going to hurt their friends, and they have to be stopped. And there is evil in the world, and there's bad in the world, and you can say, I'm sorry about how we got to that point in time, but the first and the most important order of business is for the public to be safe. And some of those kids have got to be arrested and incarcerated, and you got to work with them as best you can, but until they get their head right, or until they feel the love and the nurturing that other people would, you got to put them in a place. But that's a very, very, very small percentage of who we're talking about. You got to stop them from becoming that way, which means that you got to understand it from the public health side, and you have to stand it from the family side, and you have to understand it from the prevention side. But make no mistake about it, this is a catastrophic problem that is coursing through the veins of every neighborhood in America. And as mayors feel good about their murder per rate, I can promise you, if you go look at the data, that there are neighborhoods in every city in America where the murder rate for young African American men is exponentially higher in every city, in the safest cities, than it is for other people, women, men of color, and Caucasians, et cetera, which is why I say this is a national epidemic, and that we as a nation should focus on it like a laser beam and not water it down into something different, because we need to be politically correct. I love the President's My Brother's Keeper initiative. I'm in it. I'm part of it. I like it, but it's for black and brown. And now the ladies are coming out saying, well, why are you just focusing on the men? Why don't you focus it on us? So now we've got to have my sister's keeper. And that's all fine, too. All of that stuff is great, and we should do all of that stuff. But we should not take our eyes off of what is essentially in front of us every day. And I'm going to tell you why it's more important than all the other stuff and why it has to be done now. Because on Friday night, in this great city, less than 2 miles from here, in a neighborhood called St. Rock, my little football team was practicing for their championship game the next morning, which, by the way, was going to take place right when the book festival down the street was going to take place, where I was explaining to that little girl what the mayor did. So one enriching environment for kids, and then another one, but they were practicing. And guess who just walked by the playground? Some kid who was part of a gang who had been targeted by another. And so the other guys come down the street and they see him standing there, and they think, well, I don't care who else is standing around. I'm going to light this guy up. And, of course, they spray the entire park. And they shot a coach. And they shot a 14-year-old kid. And they missed their target. All right? And now, the next morning, we're in a session with the kids. We have all of our mental health things there. And these kids on the football team's lives have changed forever. That repeats itself over and over again. Sometimes it results in the death of Breonna Allen, 5 years old, on the porch for our cousin Danelle's 12th birthday. Her father was the intended target. They came by and they sprayed the porch with an AK-47 and blew her guts out, and she died. Right? Y'all remember the Mother's Day shooting a couple of weeks later? Y'all heard that? It was a year later. Do you know who was injured in that shooting? The little boy who was on that porch a year before. So the impact that these shootings and that these murders have on the ability for citizens to actually grow up and fold into loving, caring human beings actually goes away. And so as Ebola threatens us, as public health like ISIS threaten us, as wars threaten us, to me, there's nothing more important and more compelling and more immediate than the people being gunned down as we speak. And by the way, and I'm going to end because I'm not taking too much time, this is not just about guns. And if you go ask the young men, well, if I got your gun, this is, I find another gun. This is not, so for all the gun control people, it's not just about guns. And guess what? It's not just about jobs. Oh, if they had a job, they wouldn't shoot. Not everybody that doesn't have a job is shooting. And oh, by the way, it's just not about poverty. There are a lot of people that are in poverty that are not shooting. We have got to be open with each other and drill down in an honest way about what this is. And guess what? The answer is all of us have a piece of the responsibility for making it better. It's just not on the people that did bad things before. It's just not on the kids that are there right now. It's just not on the institutions. It's just not on the personal responsibility. Our work is taking us to it's all of the above. And we have got to find a pathway. And it's got to require us to be relentless in the work that we're doing. But essentially what it's about is these young men are valuable. They're important. And we have got to find a way to protect them so that we can protect ourselves. Thanks.
I got handed a note while the mayor was talking saying that his schedule has changed yet again. So he's going to actually have to leave in a few minutes. So we're going to wing it again and make a little shift in the program. And what I'd like to do is actually open things up to the audience. And we'll have time for probably two or three questions. So your hand went up right away.
So first of all,
can
thank you.
Because what we have found out was that a small group of these guys have become part of what would be known as, you could call them groups or gangs, not the Medellin cartel, but a bunch of cashes hanging with each other because it makes them feel good, and they have been part of a criminal enterprise that's done like 50 or 100 things. And so we have used intelligence to define this, and basically we started arresting them in groups, prosecuting them in groups. They start turning on each other, and just through suppression, get the bad guys off the street. And by the way, anyone that wants to change, and we have evidence that they have, they go to the front of the list, and then you start to move through that. Now, our murder rate in the last 2 years is as low as it's been since 1970 in the city of New Orleans. Now, we're still way too high, way, way, way too high, but there's evidence that that piece is working, all right? So that's first, stop the shooting. Multi-agency gang unit, group violence reduction strategy. The second is jobs. This is going to bring you to your knees, as it should. 52% of the young African-American men in the city are not working. Right? So we've got to get them connected to work, because there is part of the theory that if you have a job or something else to do, you're not going to be hanging on the corner hurting other people, generally speaking. Somebody can say that more eloquently than me, but they're not working and they're hurting. We need to get them working so they can be supported. And so we have created something called Pathways to Prosperity. We actually have identified them. We didn't just say, oh, it's terrible that 52% of the young men are not working. I said, well, who are they? People said, you can't know who they are. I said, don't tell me that. I'm a politician. I know who people are. When I run for office, if you lived in my city, I know where you live. I know how old you are. I know whether you're white or you're black. I know whether you're a man or a woman. I know what your address is, and I know what your voting history is. And then I target you. Remember, you get those phone calls from me, you get that mail from me, you get all that stuff. So I tell my people, we can find out who these guys are. Find out who they are. And then find out what they are. Did they drop out of school? Did they graduate and not go anywhere? Did they go to secondary school? Did they graduate from college? Who are they? Where are they? What's their skill set? Break it down. Okay, now that you know who they are, what are you going to do with them? Well, find out who's got the jobs. Oh, really? Universities, anchor institutions, bring them together. Right? Oh, LSU and Tulane, aren't y'all building a $3 billion hospital? Did you look in the neighborhood around where you live? And right in the neighborhood where you live. This is the name of the book. I'm not going to write a book. I don't know how to write a book. I will write a book. It would be, right, a mile away, a world apart. So do you know how many places in your area that you live in have all of these resources in neighborhoods right next to people that never actually can't even get in the door? How do you connect them? How do you create training? So this is something we're terrible at in this country. We're just terrible at it, right? How do you find people that need jobs and put them in the jobs that already exist? So in Louisiana, we have a good thing going right now. We have 60,000 jobs available. Oil and gas industry, natural gas, hospital, airport, rebuilding the drinking water system. So what we're doing on the jobs piece is actually going to find them, connecting them with the job, and then training them. That's the second piece. The third piece is recreation. Making sure that these kids have enrichment programs and have something to do. That's important. So we restarted. You know how everybody left at midnight basketball? Midnight basketball works. Oh, yes, it does. You pull 1,000 guys off the street, and you put them in the gym, and you put uniforms on them, and you say y'all are playing for a TV, or you plan for tickets to the Hornets game, or you plan just for the honor of being the best, guess what? A lot of juice in the gym and not a lot of juice on the street. And then all of them start working. And then if you're smart and you bring in a speaker, right, like Drew Brees, or you bring in a speaker like Anthony Davis, or you bring in a speaker like Dr. Walter Kimbrough or Dr. Norman Francis, two university presidents, you take it as an opportunity to engage them and talk to them, all of a sudden it's like watering a plant. And they start waking up, and they start participating, and they start creating a cycle of investment in the community because you care for them. See, essentially, what these kids tell you when you really speak to them, they can't articulate it this way, but they say, I have been forsaken. That is it. That is essentially it. I have been left alone. Now, there are thousands of reasons why that happened. But basically they say, in other words, you know this already, that in order to form a human being, you have to love them and nurture them. And love and nurture comes from a parent, or it comes from a teacher, or it comes from an institution who raises them up and shows them dignity. These kids that we're talking about think that they're not going to make it to their 22nd birthday, and they don't care because nobody cares about them. That's what we got here. So this is not just, like a vaccine for a public health, where you're going to stick a needle in somebody's arm and they're going to be better. This is like we all got to change if you want to fix this problem, because it takes us into some areas that we don't want to talk about, like teen pregnancy, right? It takes us into broken families. It takes us into a whole bunch of stuff. So you got to figure out how to get there. And then the next two pieces are really kind of just generally specific. Now, we have a whole book on this. This is just our imperfect way of trying to put words and programs around what we see. And so this is not rocket science, right? We have specific things, like we ask judges to do. If someone gets caught with a gun, you increase their bail, right? So that they can't get out of jail the next day. People say, well, that's terrible. I thought you don't want to put kids in jail. I don't, but I want to save them. And what we know, Operation Ceasefire, Boston, Chicago, we brought it here, is that if you can interrupt, now we all know that this works. This doesn't take a lot of experimentation to let you know that if you get heated up about something, whether it's a girl liking a boy or somebody being mad at somebody else, if you can separate everybody for a little while and let folks cool down and regain their composure and think about what they're doing, they may think better of acting on that impulse, right? That's what ceasefire is. Ceasefire is a whole bunch of people from the street. When a shooting happens, okay, everybody's got to know somebody, so they got to be people with credibility. And they go out and start talking to everybody and make sure that the reaction doesn't take place. So, 2 days before Christmas, a couple years ago, a bunch of kids playing out in the yard of a housing development. Two guys come by, try to shoot everybody. They miss each other. They always miss each other. I don't know why. And they hit the two-year-old baby, who's dead. Kiara Holmes. Mother worked right down the street at Domino's. See her Friday. Right? And so we have a call-in session the next night to reclaim the neighborhood. And while I'm standing there, looking, a voice in my ear, man, don't worry about it. We already got the guy. Okay, I want you to think about that. Don't worry about it. We already got the guy. Street retribution. Ceasefire interrupts that. So that is a programmatic response to that. And finally, on the bail, tell the judges, St. Louis had a program that said if you increase bail and you keep them in jail for another day or two and let ceasefire do their work, all of a sudden it interrupted that specific program for a problem. You probably had 1,000 of them. And so NOLA Flight's got our very imperfect response to that particular problem that's in place and why we've done it. And by the way, it's a working document. It's for you. It's yours. You can have it. Add to it. Delete from it. But here's the big thing that's important to all of us. It's a national crisis. It is as important as anything else that we're doing in this country. But for some reason, when other things happen, time, attention, money flow right away. 9/11 happens. Towers go down. We go to war. Department of Homeland Security gets made overnight. 60,000 TSA agents that look at y'all crooked when y'all go through all of those x-ray machines, boom. I mean, like, came out of nowhere. So when people tell me we don't have the money for it, I'm like, really? I don't understand. We don't have the money for it because it's not a national priority. And it's not important to us. If it was a national priority, if it was important, we would find a way to get it done. But here's the thing. They're not coming. We can scream and yell about that all they want, which is why you're left in the wilderness by yourself to figure this out, because the only people we have is ourselves. And when we get a handle on it, and when we start making it work, then they will come. Which just adds a little bit of insult to injury, but it's why the work is necessary and important, and it's why you've got to keep just moving forward. There, by the way, let me say this. This is fixable. They are valuable. This is fixable. You know you can do it, because you've done it before. I can show you examples of human beings that we have taken from where they were into a new place, and it's fixable. So we can't act like it's an insurmountable problem. It's just too hard for us to look at, because nobody really wants to talk about all of the issues, because everybody wants to blame it on something else. As soon as you talk to somebody about it, they want to talk about guns. As soon as you talk about that, they want to talk about personal responsibility. As soon as you talk about that, they want to talk about institution or whatever. And because we can't find a way to talk about all of it at the same time and get to a constructive solution, we quit talking about it. And because it's so hard, we walk away from it. And because it's not our kids. I didn't just make a racial statement. I'm talking about middle-class African-Americans, middle-class politicians who are African-American, and white people saying, hey, why are you talking to me? Those are not my kids. those are in a different place, and because it doesn't affect you because you're not a target, you're like, no problem. You know what that means? They're disposable. And the thing is, they're not. And so in this nation at this time, if you think about it, there is a convergence taking place. Rand Paul was on Bill Maher last night. Rand Paul. You don't know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Libertarian, everybody thinks he's over there. Bill Maher was way over there. Right? Ted Cruz. You know who Ted Cruz is? Way over there, Wackadack stuff. Right? Newt Gingrich. Oh my goodness, you know all the conservatives are talking about? They're talking about prison reform. You know why? Because it's financially smart. And they're beginning to realize that the way that we approach this thing doesn't make any sense. You who are not of that persuasion politically should take them up on that offer and do not be afraid that they're going to say something like, well, y'all have to have better values. Y'all have to have personal responsibility. We do. And y'all have to have more sense about what y'all do. We do. But we have a moment in this country right now, notwithstanding what the president's about to do, and Congress saying they won't work with him, and nobody's going to talk to each other for the next 2 years on prison reform, on youth justice reform, on violence reform. You have a convergence. I don't know why the stars are lining up this way, but I would take advantage of it and run to the difficulty and run to the conflict rather than run away from it. And I think we'll make some great progress. All right, I got to get out of here. Thank y'all so much. I appreciate it.
Gunshots, a lot of them, okay, that are raining out around.
Southeast and Southwest Philadelphia, and that 47 rounds, 47 bullets are discharged errantly into a house, into all over the place, around the park, and thank God not one child in that whole park was shot. Okay? Very challenging time. My wife and I are thinking, what are we going to do? You know, this is a neighborhood that I know, that my mother grew up in, okay, that I know very well. What are we going to do? I go to the district commander, police commander, and I say, someone who I know as well, and I say, what are we going to do about this? How are we going to change this? You know what he told me? He said, you should just move. You should leave the neighborhood. So that was the solution I got. Now, in follow-up to that, it really made me start to think about what are our options in our big cities. Now, it's been said that the federal government has all the money, the states have all the power, and the cities have all the problems. Okay? But, in fact, the fact that the cities have all the problems and the federal government and the state government aren't there to bail them out, this is what Bruce Katz in his book, The Metropolitan Revolution, says, that cities have come to recognize that the cavalry is not coming. They are forced to innovate on their own and come up with real solutions. I think what the mayor said, practical solutions to difficult and pressing problems. The cities are left to do this on their own. Cities like Philadelphia and other cities around the country that we've studied at the Urban Health Lab at the University of Pennsylvania have come up with some truly creative solutions. They have partnered with their local universities, much as was just discussed, with their local eds and meds, right? These anchor institutions that offer a job base to the city, but also offer scientific and evaluation support for a lot of these new programs. Could be Nola for Life. In the case of the city of Philadelphia, I had been involved in a number of programs similar to some of the programs that were talked about where they were conflict resolution programs in the neighborhoods. They were trying to teach non-aggressive behavior to kids in the neighborhoods. And quite frankly, they were not having the success they should have. I then, just by chance, went to a meeting of the Federal Reserve Bank. I was invited there to give a talk about some of the work we had been doing with alcohol outlets in the city of Philadelphia and in a couple other cities around the country as well. I met a person there who was talking about urban development and development of vacant spaces, vacant and related spaces. And his language about this was that these are not challenges, these are opportunities for our cities. But he was talking about it, and the city of Philadelphia was implementing at the time, beginning to implement a vacant lot cleaning and greening program. Not for purposes of health, not for purposes of safety, but for purposes of economic development. They wanted to drive up housing values in the city, and in some of the more challenged neighborhoods in the city, they wanted to, if a developer were driving by one of the enclosed spaces, and it didn't have weeds, and vegetation taller than me in it, and various other things, tires, old sofas, who knows, old cars and so forth. If that was not there, and it was nice and green, nice and clean, had opportunities in that space, and can you imagine if there were a block of, where there's a dozen of these, and all 12 of them had been redone, the visual difference in that space would have been dramatic. Well, I said, wow, maybe there's some health and safety implications to doing this. So the Urban Health Lab undertook a study, a decade-long study, to look at the implications of doing this clean and green program, and what we found was pretty striking. First, health effects, we did find that people's stress levels went down around the people who live near the newly green vacant lot. We found that people's inactivity went down. They were exercising more. We also found that little nuisance crimes went down, and that once you green these spaces and clean them in the neighborhood, people take an interest in them. The spaces suddenly tended, you know, people feel like they need to protect the space going forward. If there's any kind of little activity that might resemble a crime, they call 911 something. So the 911 call rate went up pretty dramatically. But perhaps the most interesting finding that we had was that gun violence and gun crime in and around these lots went down significantly. And we think that is participate in the illegal drug economy are actually business people just like anyone else. The difference is, legal economy, they can't call 911 when they have a business dispute, and they must keep their weapons nearby, okay? But they can't keep those weapons on them. They know that their sentences will go up dramatically, those weapons are on them, so they're always looking for places to put their weapons that they have access to them quickly, and can use them in dispute in the vacant lots. Were a real place for that. And so when you clean and green them and you change things, physical changes to the neighborhood, that made a huge difference in terms of the gun crime. Now, I don't have a whole lot more to say because I want to take most of your questions, but I hope we have a chance to talk more as a group. Going back to my comment about the police district captain asking us to just move, I think we've had a lot of solutions for urban problems that have been just that. Have been seeking to change people, or forcing people to change, and seeking, if not, to just relocate them. I don't see the need for us to always consider forcing people to the great speaker yesterday, to the warmth of other suns. There's no reason to do that. The spaces within which people live, work, and play every day should be altered, and then I think you'll see a lot more positive impact on them, and perhaps, as we're finding in Philadelphia and other cities, reduction in things, nasty things like violence and other crimes in those spaces. Thank you.
Our last speaker before we open things up for discussion again is Beatrice Solis. She's from the California Endowment. And I have to say, the work that the California Endowment is doing in terms of community empowerment and working with communities to help communities make choices for themselves around these kinds of issues is incredibly impressive. That's why we asked her to be here, so she'll be talking about that.
Great, thank you, Howard. Hi, everyone, good morning. Speaking for my health foundation, I'm totally okay if folks want to stand and stretch. Don't take offense to that at all. I think, in these meetings sometimes you just get tired sitting down, so please feel comfortable if you need to get up and stretch. At the California Endowment, we're one of the largest health foundations. We're a conversion foundation. We focus on California. And about 7 years ago, our CEO put us down a path to really look at what strategies can be addressed to really deal with deep issues. And at the time, the endowment, we had like 35 different strategies that we were employing all across the state. And then when we looked to see where we actually effectuated change, where are those nuggets where something is happening, that there is long-term for larger groups change occurring. And we saw the sweet sauce of statewide advocacy and grassroots advocacy. So you could get wins at a local level, but they only take you so far. You can have wins at the statewide level, and it will only take you so far. But if you have a combination of local advocates and statewide advocates working together, then you're seeing greater change occurring across the state for many low-income communities of color in California. So there we went to do place-based work. So we're focusing on 14 communities, Richmond being one in the audience, and both rural, urban, suburban communities. And what we learned from other place-based initiatives is that you really need to let people vote with their feet. So one, we decided we're going to make a 10-year funding commitment. Two, being wonky at the foundation as well, we have adopted a frame of social determinants of health. So basically what Charlie was saying, where you live, play, pray, make a difference and it's important. So there's oodles, oodles of data that show the place is incredibly important. And then we said, okay, 14 communities decide on what priorities are important for you all. But make sure that you're bringing young people, residents, nonprofits, and what we call systems leaders, folks with it that work in the system, regardless of what system, and make a decision. Well, again, what was fascinating across all 14, there are three big things that came up across the 14. Violence prevention was top. The other was economic development, and the other was what we sort of bucketed as sort of healthcare-related issues. So when it came to violence prevention, we said, okay, what strategies, tactics that you want to use on the ground? And so fast forward, now I can tell you after 4 years of implementation, sort of what has been the journey of what we've heard from people about what strategies work and don't work. At the Health Foundation, I would say, because I've been with the foundation 7.5 years, we did not fund robustly school discipline issues or school truancy issues. We did. Today, it's happening in all 14 places. Why? Because we listen to young people. What they said is that we want to graduate, but you know what? There are particular veins that lead to the artery of prison, that school to prison pipeline. And so through ground truthing, through, again, our lens is really policy and systems change and community engagement. And so these young people doing ground truthing found out that there was disproportionality happening. So what does that disproportionality mean? Well, once you begin to look at the money, where does the money flow? How do kids get to school? Who's there at school? A picture emerges. So the picture that emerged was that you had kids that were taking public transportation to get to school. However, for low-income communities, the transportation wasn't reliable. So kids were on their way to school, but guess what? The bus, the rail, whatever was getting them late to school. They couldn't rely on that. So then an advocacy campaign started out of that. How do you make sort of the transportation department aware of it, the local transportation department? And then how do you make sure that kids get a free bus pass? So in one of the communities in City Heights, they pushed for free bus passes for young people. What was the other strategy? The other strategy was, it was a law enforcement strategy, which was that you have these low-income communities that were getting truancy tickets for each one, $250. And if you don't have that discretionary money, it piles up. And if you don't tell your mom or dad, it piles up. And that's where kids get onto this conveyor belt. So they said, we've collected enough data to show that in East LA and South LA, so black and brown kids, and if we compare it with the west side, with white kids, guess what? More kids of color were getting disproportionately higher truancy tickets. So what they pushed for was a moratorium. So all of these young people got together, they organized, they met up with the mayor and chief of police and said, hey, here's the data. And at that moment, the chief could not dispute the data and said, we're doing a moratorium now. And that led to young people being incorporated into understanding and teaching law enforcement, as well as empowering themselves about what strategies needed to come up. So what I would say is that what we've learned is to be very humble and to listen to those strategies that people have in community, but fund them. You gotta fund them, and you gotta trust. You gotta really trust that these things will happen. The third thing that we heard was that we've heard many things, but one is around what we call sort of healing and restorative practices. So I think it was alluded to by the prior two speakers, but I got to tell you, again, as a health funder, we were not deep in trauma-informed care, we weren't deep in restorative justice, we weren't deep in all of those areas. And so what community, again, told us was that there's a lot of healing that happens. And two, don't shy away, California Endowment, from funding hard conversations about race, around class, around structural racism, and the impact historically over communities. But what did that look like? People wanted to have that conversation. They really wanted to have that conversation to be able to acknowledge, one, yeah, it exists. And two, how do we begin to build bridges? And three, what is it about healing? So I'll give you a story of a young man in South Los Angeles. And again, you probably see this kid anywhere in many large cities. 13 years old, was in the foster care system, did not have much relations with family, didn't make it through school, you know, was constantly being in and out of school. This kid's now 16. This kid is now finished school, is interning at an ad agency, and is now a public speaker. How did that happen? And I think it's what the mayor said, is you have to, we're sometimes a society that throws people away. We do not embrace, we let our human capital just dissipate. And so what we saw in this young man was that he had a lot of pain. And I'm just using him as an example. But there's many communities, many individuals that have multiple pain. So how do you do that? And the young people said, you know what, we really want to have, we want to learn the skills of how to conduct our own restorative justice circles. And so what we did as a foundation, we provided technical assistance support so that young people can actually get the skills to be able to talk about that pain and talk about all those issues that they want to talk about in a safe space, in a space where there's strong facilitation. And guess what? These kids are able to conduct multiple circles as well as educate adults about how they're healing and how they're moving. So this young man that I was talking about, he was making money selling fruit on the corner. You know, he was just trying to make some extra money. So he'd buy fruit from a local, you know, fruit market, cut it up, and sell it. So he was engaging with some other young people that he knew, and they said, hey, come on, be part of our advocacy campaign. We're going to do X, Y, and Z. You know, for, it took 2 years to get this kid in. But once the kid came in, realized that, wow, I have all of these other friends now that I can lift my voice. I don't have to be afraid. I can go in front of city council and advocate. I can talk to the school board. So you build the capacity of this young person that will then, over the span of their life, are transformed. So when I think of, who's familiar with Dolores Huerta? Okay, a few. She was what we would consider the number two of the United Farm Workers. So if you begin to look at individuals, anybody that you respect in the social justice movement, if you look at where they started out, it was somebody who cared, somebody who mentored them, somebody that said, hey, what, you're important, your voice is important, and then directing them, and then they take off and do absolutely amazing things. I'm sure just in this room alone, we can come up with, you know, 200, 300 names of individuals who have been transformed. I'm one of those. I grew up in a neighborhood where I'm 0.01% that has a PhD, where 50% of the kids were dropped out of school or pushed out. Pushed out is a term that young people use. You know, brownfields, Superfund site, all there. So you have that multitude. The other piece that we learned is that you have to push on what the mayor was saying. So you gotta break down the silos. You know, you gotta break down the silos. And it's very hard to break down silos because people love their silos. And they love their funding and their reporting. But for transformational change, when you see these young people and the life opportunity that they have in front of you, then it sort of lands. I would say the other piece that we learned is that it's incredibly hard work in terms of trust. And I think for folks that work in public health, we understand that, but bringing other partners, it's important for them to understand it. So when you work in community, what community told us is when you're working on violence prevention, they don't necessarily want the chief police in the room at the beginning, nor do they want the local police officer in the meeting at the beginning, because there's a lack of trust. And so being real about trust is very important, just as it is important to think about race and all of these other factors. And how do you begin to build that trust over time? There may not be agreement on everything, on every issue, but where there is agreement, that's where I think public health can be incredibly important in building bridges between systems to say, you know, how do you deliberately start moving the needle? And I'll just sort of end it with saying that it's real patient work. Because these issues are very, very complicated, very entrenched. But I think taking a what we call sort of a power building piece, you can do the systems piece, you can align systems and funds. I don't, again, agree that it's not rocket science, you can make that happen. But if you don't have community voice, residents and young people, you know, we sort of call it people power, but you need that people power piece in there. Because things will occur in the neighborhood, issues will emerge that are going forward, and you need people to be engaged and informed so that they're really transforming and keeping systems accountable. Because at the end of the day, as well, you need people in community, you need to keep systems accountable to make sure that the funding is going right, that they're dealing with these issues. So I would just sort of end it there, and then I guess we're going to Q&A.
Thank you. You know, before I open things up to questions, I want to go back to how I started, which is 30 years ago when I got involved in this. It was a pretty barren landscape, and the solutions were totally rooted in containment, which we've heard people talk about, and throwing kids away, essentially. And I think you've gotten a nice taste of how rich the landscape is now in terms of creative solutions, engaging communities, changing environments that young people are in, and how responsive young people can be to these changes, and how powerful this is. And we're seeing real change in this country because of that. Homicide rates are falling. Young people are less involved in violence. We still have a long way to go, but we've made an incredible start. And the work in Philadelphia and California and New Orleans, which I said wrong again, and other places are incredible examples that should tell everybody that this can be done in every city and every community in this country. So I want to thank the speakers, and I want to open things up for questions or comments. One, two.
All right, so these are fantastic presentations. Thank you so much. My question is for you, Dr. Brown, about Flint. So what you said about the cleaning and greening, I think there's one thing I've heard there that works for that and one thing that works against. In terms of the poor, what they do is they actually will take burned out houses, knock them down, make the space green, and then deed it to the neighbors. So that works with, you know, maintaining and all that. So I think that's good from what you said. The challenge, I think, is that if the area is so economically deprived, our police force is a third of what it was and what it really should be. So if you call 911, no one comes. So when you said about, you know, the neighbors call 911, well, it doesn't matter really. I mean, it kind of matters, but not really. But you have thoughts about that?
So for our cleaning and greening program, remediation of vacant spaces in the city of Philadelphia. We also have a sister work that we're doing in terms of the remediation of abandoned buildings, which do not get raised as well. And both of them seem to have similar effects. As far as the police response, when we first started doing this work, the police commissioner of Philadelphia, which I was very surprised about, stood up and very much supported it, and he called it an example of soft policing. These changes to spaces and changes to places, and was we thought that this was going to, because the Philadelphia Police Department is most police departments in major cities, is the largest cost center of the city. We thought that was going to be a threat, that because this is being done as a public-private venture from the Office of Housing and Community Development in the City of Philadelphia, the Department of License and Inspections, non-police departments, we thought it was going to be threatening, but in fact it was not. It was the opposite. The police commissioner looked at this and said, these are opportunities for us where we can redistribute our resources where they're more needed if you can show reductions, which have been shown in select neighborhoods where this cleaning and greening has been done. And the city of Philadelphia over a decade did 8 million square feet of this. Now that might sound like a lot, and it might sound costly, but that cost on a per square foot basis, it's not $1, $1 per square foot to do this, is far less than the cost of police resources. So there are great advantages there in that space. It's again an example of what soft policing.
You know, I again, with limited time, it's hard to pick and choose what to talk about, but we're funding a lot. I mean, I think community, again, connects the built environment and violence prevention and health. What does it mean for a healthy community? So the strategies that have been identified have been sometimes where there's just high density, it's how to reclaim alleys. And so we funded efforts to reclaim alleys. And what that means is that families actually use that space. They have Friday night movies, they have street vending, etc. So they're reclaiming space. I guess if I had to put a big umbrella, it's people are reclaiming public space. And so I would say alleys is an interesting way to do that. Another way is through arts and culture. And that, for me, crosswalks back to belonging, cherishing one's history, no matter how complicated and terrible it might have been, but what is it about? But acknowledging, you know, sort of history. And arts and culture for a health foundation was a big shift because, you know, how do you get people where they're at? And if I'm sure if folks think about Marvin Gaye's song, guess which one? Anybody guess? What's going on? What's going on? All you have to do is play a song like that that maybe in Khmer, it could be another one in Spanish, could be in Farsi, could be whatever language. Every culture has a song. You know, South Africa, we know many songs that came out of that movement. But when you have something that can just, like, you know, give you goosebumps and make you feel like, wow, it's not just me, right? It's not just me and my neighborhood. It's much bigger than that. You're reclaiming your history. And so arts and culture, oh my goodness, has been such an exciting path. And having people tell their own stories from their own land. So we have a website. It's called Departures. It's a partnership with public television to really let communities kind of tell their story in multiple ways. So I would say the other part is arts and culture are really exciting strategies to, again, animate, engage people around these really tough issues.
Yeah, if I could just add one comment also, there are good ways and bad ways of doing this stuff. So it's not just that you start it. There's some good science and some good experience in this. You can design green space that can be very healthy and functional. You can also design green space that increases risk. And so you have to have the right people at the table designing or helping to design the space to be smart about it. You don't have a park with a dead end because you can't police it, which seems obvious when somebody says it. You don't think about this stuff if you don't have the right people at the table helping you think this through so you do it as smartly as possible. So it's important to do this work, but to do it well and to get people who have done this before to help you. And there's lots of people out there who have done this. There's a question in the back.
Yeah, my question is...
You're going to have to speak up.
You referred to teenager or young college pushed out of school rather than drop out. Could you tell me why do they see it like that rather than
That's a really good point. And I think what we've learned is that young people feel things being done to them, right? And so when you begin to, again, I say this in all honesty, being really humble, to look through their eyes, sort of what they see and experience every day. So when we think of post-Columbine, we have a whole host of zero tolerance policies. When you look at it from a lens of a kid, they just see that, oh, okay, I did this one thing in school, and now I'm in detention, and now I can't get back into school. So they see that the unintended consequences of sometimes policies that were created for, you know, a good reason, right, unfortunately are having an impact on kids of color. And so they begin to see and identify them as they don't want us in school, right? Because if a school district, let's say Los Angeles Unified School District, the second largest in the nation, you have
over 15 million that spend on policing, paying for police on campus, and only 2 million for restorative justice, a young person who's analyzing that are saying maybe the priorities are not there in terms of keeping us in school. So again, it's that level of analysis that's sort of happening in each of the 14 communities.
Again, I want to add, schools need to be places where kids feel like they can succeed, and too much, it's going the other way, where schools are places where kids fail. And they fail for many reasons, including they feel like prisons, they look bad, their things dropped because of budget cuts that are so important to kids, like the arts and music programs, things like that. Those are the kinds of things we have to pay better attention to. There's a million hands up. 1, 2, 3.
I would say that we were very naive at the beginning. We had what we put forward were a set of principles and values. So we conscientiously made the decision not to select organizations, because all too many times what we heard was that if you go into X community, oh, if you give it to that organization, it's going to be their thing, and they're not going to open it up to everybody, and it's going to be their program. So we didn't want that. And then if you give it to a local public health department, it's like, oh, well, they're not committed to them, you know? So no matter how you would do it, there was always going to be pushback. So it's very, very messy. And I would say in that messiness, transformation happens. And so it's being okay, and again, in the foundation where we look at data and metrics and we want to see that, we said, hey, this is a totally different thing. So we created support, meaning technical assistance support. We provided whatever resources the community needed to have meetings to decide how they wanted to govern themselves, how they wanted to set up the collaborative. So in one community in San Diego, they brought out almost 500 people in a stadium to vote and decide who was going to be the convener of the conversation. So, again, it's being okay with that happening. And then, I would say, in another community, they said, you know what, after 2 years, you know what, we're noticing that the table is not inclusive of certain groups. So maybe we need to restart, or maybe we need to see how we engage those groups. And so it's an iterative process. And the analogy that I use is sometimes people come on and off the bus, you know, depending. And it, you have to be generative, you have to be, you know, build that muscle and be okay for folks to come in, you know, on and off the bus at different times.
Yeah, we have time for two more questions and we're going to be kicked out of here. So 1, 2.
So I work with a college-age population that is just, they were the kids who grew up in those tough neighborhoods. Who were given a little bit of a chance, who found that one individual. And so hopefully they're going to be the next public health professionals. But I'm finding I can't give them the literature that writes up your finding and have them really be able to see it, hold it, touch it, understand it, do something with it. So I'm just interested in how you feel about educating those, you know, at the next level. I have, you know, they're tenuous. I can lose them if I don't really.
For our work, so maybe two answers for you, and then I'll pass it to Andrew Sue. I'm trying to engage them in the work. So much of the work we do is actual community changes, the structural and physical environment of the community. And to the extent that you can get kids out there, hopefully kids who are part of that neighborhood that's being changed, I think there's a lot of benefit to that. But for their engagement, but also so that they can, you know, they will point to that for the decades to come, that they were part of making that part of what we have in that building. The other thing is, don't have them read our academic scientific articles. I wouldn't recommend that at all. but, you know, what we have in the Urban Health Lab at Penn is we have a pretty robust press office. And so when something comes out, someone in our press office translates it, and I don't know, some agency in New York Times, New CNN picks it up, and they do a fantastic translation of what just happened, way better than we could do. So you're welcome to visit our website and look at all the press coverage. They're very short. They're a little one-pager, so they can motivate the general public and kids as well.
So the trends that we're seeing in the state of California is one, you know, really take advantage of the practicum. And so at UC Berkeley and at UCLA, we're working with the public health departments to connect them with community organizations that are doing policy and advocacy work. And so students get engaged with campaigns that really have momentum. And what we've learned is that once they get involved and engaged, it's just mind-blowing. They're just so excited and engaged with public health and, again, all of the broad aspects of public health. Another is whenever you can, encourage your partners to take in students. So I have one back there, one, raise your hand. So one, we've taken in interns. We think that that's a great way of bringing in the next generation, which is also critical.
Last question.
Hi. I really appreciate this with DOJ's at the Public Health Conference, so I'm happy that you're here. But, you know, I think Peter's comments about, like, trust and, you know, kind of building that trust with community members and the local law enforcement, and then that in line with, in a lot of the communities I work in, for many of the communities Peter's funds, like, seeing this militarization of the police departments with tanks and, you know, and they literally feel like they are in a war. And so how is, like, you being here at the public, how are you taking the public health lens to kind of reconcile, like, building trust, but also, you know, making sure our local police departments do have the tools they need?
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, please. I'm an example of how I think the justice system is trying to change with this. They recruited me to be deputy director of NIJ because I'm a public health person. I'm a pediatrician. I have no criminal justice background whatsoever. But their understanding is, I think, what public health has been learning for a very long time, that our work is multidisciplinary and that we all need to be talking to each other. And this has to happen at a community level, it has to happen at a government level, it has to happen at a national level. So this change takes a while, and there are trends that are not going necessarily in the best directions. But I think there's an understanding that needs to change. And so there are now public health people at the Justice Department, and there'll be more of them. But the flip side is happening too, which is that the CDC is beginning to bring in people with criminal justice backgrounds so that we start speaking the same language. You know, one of the first things I saw when I went to the CDC, where I was for 3 years before I went to Justice, was I went to a conference that was a mixture of criminal justice people and public health people. And us public health people kept talking about violence, and the criminal justice people kept talking about crime.
Yeah.
Well, we were talking about the very same thing, and we didn't know it. And so we have to start learning similar languages. We have to exchange in ways that we learn from each other. And we have to begin to break down these silos and become less territorial and turfy about this work. Not easy. But it can happen, and I'm seeing it happen at a federal level, I'm seeing it happen at local levels, I'm seeing it happen among foundations that are becoming increasingly collaborative around this work, we're seeing it happen in academia, where people are crossing departments and getting joint appointments and working together in ways they haven't before. It's really exciting, and it's one of the reasons I think we've seen such a rich landscape developing in this field.